Hi, guys. Thank you for being so patient. These guys are worth waiting for. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Sarah Zorn. I am the food editor for Brooklyn Magazine. So this weekend is like Christmas for me. I am excited to be here, especially with this panel. So I'm also the host of the Taste Talks podcast on Heritage Radio. We just wrapped our first season, but this is going to be recorded for a very special episode of Taste Talks on Heritage Radio. So for the integrity of the audio, could you please make sure to turn off your phones, which I'm sure you did anyway, although I forget to all of the time. All right, cool, let us get into it. I'm so excited to be sitting on stage with our incredible panel today, which is perfectly poised to talk about the topic of how you stay relevant in an age when newness is all. So please help me welcome Mr. Cronut himself, Dominique Ansel. I'm sure he hates that I called him Mr. Cronut. Dominique Ansel. You can raise the roof. We just don't want to hear your phones, but we do want to hear you cheer. Next, we have Luke Ostrom of the NoHo Hospitality Group behind Little Park and Lafayette and the Dutch and probably three more restaurants within the coming year. Luke, thank you so much for being here. Finally, we have the incredible Marco Canora of the James Beard Award nominated multiple times, Hearth. He was also the reason that we were all lining up for bone broth this year, amazingly, as well as laminated pastries with his new takeout window, Brodo. Thank you guys for being here. Give it up for Marco. So, as I said, you are really the perfect panel for today's discussion of relevance because you have all in very quantifiable ways affected what we eat and why and where. So as a member of the food media, I take a lot of onus for the fact. I'm sorry, I apologize. I know I'm complicit, but can you guys speak to the kind of environment that has been created around food today and how you have navigated the what's new and what's next phenomenon in an industry that's really obsessed with newness?
You know, I try to stay abreast of what's happening, and I certainly ingest a lot of restaurant information in terms of what's happening in the world that we all work in. However, I use it as a way to like think of other things. So I, you know, at Hearth and with Brodo and 50 Paces, I really try to not follow the trends, and I think that the real value in Dominique is like the greatest example of this, is like to create something new that is out of the ordinary is really the secret to creating energy and interest. You know, nobody has interest in seeing the same old things that they've seen everywhere. So, you know, I think ingesting information and being curious and trying to think creatively out of the box to create the new thing is really what it's about.
Again, being new is not exactly a sustainable game plan. So do you find yourselves succumbing to the pressure of creating stories or just, you know, coming up with something that's going to get you a quick write-up in a publication in that effort to constantly keep yourself in the public consciousness? Because new is fleeting, obviously. You can't always be new.
Yeah, new runs out pretty fast. So if you come up with a new idea or you open up a new business, obviously that sort of moment passes by. And I think a lot of it really comes down to continuing to tell a really good story, you know. And I think if you put something together, whether it be a really good product and something that's original, something that's delicious, or something that's unique, is, you know, once that's established, being able to continue the dialogue, continue the story as you evolve, in my case, with restaurants, you know, they do age, obviously, and you want to sort of stand to the principle of what you've created, but you also have to adapt to the reality of what people want a little bit. And I think that can be seen in menu evolution or conversation or partaking in different things that are going around, but still kind of holding true and fast to what that original intention was and the reason why, hopefully, you were successful in the first place.
So what's your take on it, Dominique? Because it's really, you've got a lot of chefs and pastry chefs running scared, feeling like they need to keep up with the craze around your latest pastry. So what's your take on how do you navigate that world of being innovative, but then still, you know, remaining relevant once all of the excitement has worn off?
Well, I'm going to start by saying, like, something very simple and straightforward. You have to be yourself. You cannot force into, like, creating something to get press, to get more people to you. You have to be yourself, and if you're naturally creative, if you naturally believe that you can do something new and something else, like, you just naturally do it. I remember when we launched the Cornet 2 years ago, I'm sure most of you know about it, people were just, like, coming to me and asking me for our marketing strategy and our PR campaign and how many people we had, like, organizing this. And to me, it was crazy for people to think that one little bakery in Soho could have, like, this kind of, like, power of hiring, like, a whole team of marketing. It does not exist. It's something that happened naturally, something that happened, like, just by itself, and it's a true story. It's not something you can buy. You can hire, like, an entire team. You can have, like, a huge amount of money. You cannot buy the real product and the real story. And this is what I believe in. This is what I push myself to do all the time. So at the bakery, we change the menu every 6 to 8 weeks. And this is something we've been doing since we opened the shop. It's not something new. And staying true to yourself and to what you believe in, it's something important. So constantly, like, thinking on how you can connect with people and how you can give them emotion through food, that's something important for me.
I think that the fact that all three of you have been in some way honored and recognized by the James Beard Awards really says something about this amazing hat trick that you have managed to pull off. Obviously, you have your finger on the pulse of what's new and exciting, the fact that, you know, years after opening Hearth, you're still really getting accolades for it. So it does speak to you still being very keyed in to what is exciting people now as opposed to 10 years ago. But on the other hand, with all three of you, it speaks to you really sticking to your guns and maintaining a certain amount of integrity. So I guess, do you agree with that statement? And if so, how have you managed to strike that really incredible balancing act?
You know, the authenticity thing is a really great point, because I think you can't manufacture this stuff. Like, the Cronut was not, like, this idea that he sat down and said, I need to come up with this idea. It's like, it was organic and it was authentic. And the same thing with the broth thing for me. It's like, people ask the same questions, like, how did you do that? And it's like, it happened by itself, right? And it wasn't premeditated or, you know, like, I have to think of something. It just, things happen organically. And when they do, and they're authentic and they speak to you, then that usually equates to a success. In terms of the relevance thing, like, I think for Hearth, you know, it's putting aside ego and really connecting with guests and really understanding. I think in this town especially, there's a lot of big egos at a lot of big restaurants. And I know for my wife and I going out, like, there's nothing worse than that uptight New York City, like, you should be honored to be sitting in my cool, happening, busy restaurant. Like, that is something I think that irks a lot of people in the dining public in town. And we have always kind of, we've gone out of our way to not be that place and to be incredibly grateful and welcoming and warm. And, like, you know, our shtick was, we have no shtick when we opened 12 years ago. And we've really stuck to that and tried to just stay to the basics of, like, quality ingredients and tasty food with a smile. And it sounds so silly and basic, but I think that that's somewhat rare in this town, to feel connection to a restaurant and to actually have a family of people that believe in those values and are grateful for business.
So social media, perhaps even more than traditional print or even online media, has definitely shaped food and restaurant culture today. So how have the three of you been utilizing social media and do you think when you are conceptualizing or even plating a dish, wow, how is this going to look at Instagram? How will this appear in somebody's, you know, smartphone camera?
Yeah, I think it's incredible to watch what's happened with social media, specifically in the restaurant business, over the past few years. At one point, I think going out to eat was a piece of a lifestyle that you would partake in on a nightly basis or a weekly basis or a monthly basis, where you would go to an event and maybe you would grab a bite to eat on the way or when you were done, and then you would talk about the event, you'd talk about the movie you just saw. And now I think eating out in restaurants and is lifestyle in a sense. People go out to eat and that is their whole night. And as soon as they get to the table, they're already talking about the meal while they're there. And they're now also photographing the meal, and then they're actually sending instant messaging or Instagram or tweeting about the meal. And it's quickly changed where information sharing is so fast now that I think you do have to keep that in mind as far as what you do professionally on a daily basis, whether it be something you might say or how you present something. But I don't know. I think you also have to take a little bit with a grain of salt. There's a certain reality that not to keep going back to the same point, but if the underlying nature of what you do is authentic to you, and if you're putting out something that you really believe in and something that, you know, your heart and soul is, or the product and quality of the ingredient that you're cooking with, or the type of restaurant that you're making, it's less necessarily about all the residual noise that's happening around that, even though that can sometimes affect it in a negative way or a positive way. There's no question about it. But we do rely on social media certainly as part of our whole programming. There's no question that it's incredibly relevant. It's incredibly now. And it really is an amazing tool to share information very quickly about what's going on. And, you know, if you are doing something new within your restaurant, you've created a new dish, or it's an opportunity, a platform for people to be able to speak and hopefully enjoy more upon it by using those platforms.
So, Dominique, you're being a little cagey, I'm sure entirely honest, about the fact that you don't have this huge PR team, just like, you know, a little factory of people figuring out what's going to be the next Cronut. But come on, you've practically broken Instagram with creations like the Cronut. So it's not even a glimmer in your mind when you're working in the test kitchen?
I think it's the social media, it's something that we should all embrace. And it's a part of this new generation. And we're all a part of it. It is something that it's a great tool when it's used properly. Of course, you cannot use social media to promote everything you do. It still has to be organic, and it has to be true to what you do every day. And it's a great way to reach out to people that wants to know about what you do and how you do things. And it is something that I think this new generation should embrace and use the right way.
So, you know, taking the fact that the Cronut was not a calculated maneuver per se, and all of the things that came after it, the broth came from someplace really organic with you, which hopefully you could speak to later, how that even became a thing in your brain, because to me, broth is what, you know, convalescence and my hippie dippy in-laws in Syracuse drink, and not a huge food trend. But so if those were not super calculated and just came directly from you, what is your personal response to all of the frenzy that came out of it? What is your take on why your pastries and your broth has exploded in the way that they both have?
I mean, I can say that a lot of people always ask the same kind of question, like, why do you think you went viral? Why do you think that people talk about it? Why do you think that people keep on lining up? And I always say the same thing. We stay true to ourselves, and I believe in quality. I believe in respecting our customers. For example, every day at the bakery, we have between 100 to 150 people lining up, and we want to make sure that we take care of them as soon as they get here. I know earlier we were talking about family, about welcoming people, about being a real business, and about having staff that cares. And it's not about selling something and try to cash out. It's really about caring for people. We have a line of 100 people every day, and we welcome them very early in the morning. We bring them hot chocolates, madeleines. We really take a good care of them so they have a great experience. So there's so many things that we do every day that makes something popular, or that makes something that people something that is real, that people believe in, and not just something like super commercial that you're trying to sell out.
Well, broth is obviously not commercial, to say the least. So talk about, it obviously came from a real place in you, a practical place, a health-driven place. So talk about, what made you decide to market this to the public and why you think it caught on the way it did.
You know, it's funny to look at it next to the cronut because they couldn't be further
away. Oh, they're diametrically opposed.
They really are diametrically opposed.
They have something similar, though.
I'm sorry?
They have something similar, probably.
Right. I know, we're trying to find out what is the similarity between.
It's a fun study to look at because they really are on opposite ends of the spectrum, it's like he's got, processed flour and sugar, and he made this sweet treat, and like people are obsessing over it. I mean, 150 people a day.
Comfort food, that's what it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. They're both comforting. That's a great point. I mean, one happens to be really, really good for you, and the other is...
It's really good for you, too.
Exactly. That's a really wonderful point. I think they both speak to something we all crave, and that is that feeling of, it's very satisfying, it's very comforting, soothing, it kind of makes you feel good, it triggers, with all the brain study that's happening out in the world, it's like, this notion of triggering areas of your brain that you want triggered is real, and things like cronuts and things like incredibly umami-driven, salty beverages like broth, there's literally chemicals and endorphins that happen in your brain. So on a scientific level, it's like we actually hit those marks with the things that we're serving. A lot of it is sheep mentality, and it's hard to attribute how much of it goes to the sheep mentality concept, right? Everybody loves to see a line. When you track the way things go, and it's like the early adopters, and then people see it, and it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it explodes. That's something that also, there's history and proof and science behind how that works. So it's really a complicated question, the why. We happen to be in the greatest city in the world, and I think being in New York City is part of the reason why, because people are so hungry and interested and kind of smart, and they consume a lot of information, and they want to kind of try things, and they explore, and they're aware. So I think where we are has a lot to do with it, too. So there's a host of reasons.
I think it's connected by emotions. Because, like, we talk about comfort food, and yes, it's something that makes you feel good, something that makes you feel comfortable, something that you've had before, that is, like, good or better. And it's emotions is something very important that I take in consideration every time I create something new. I want to reach out to people, and I want people to understand the food. That's very important. Not only like eating something because you're hungry, eating something and having this something that you eat bring you back to a certain place with certain people whom you love, and giving you emotions and making you feel like really comfortable about what you eat. And really enjoying it.
But the question is, like, in a city of 20,000 restaurants, there's a lot of people serving and producing these comfort food type things, right? And some of them hit the way the cronut hit, and others are lost in obscurity. I mean, there's no shortage of comfort food, so it's kind of hard to attribute the success to the fact that it's comfort food, because there's hundreds of thousands of opportunities in the city to get comfort food.
It's a little bit of the perfect storm, I think. I mean, I'd say any success that there is, whether it be a cronut or brodo or a restaurant or any phenomenon particularly, it's that perfect mix of timing and space and demographics and what people are feeling that year and what people are writing about that year and what city you happen to be in, plus something delicious and very comforting and has a lot of soul. Because I agree, I think there's a lot of people that are certainly... their heart and soul are certainly into the products that they're potentially putting out or coming up with original ideas and don't necessarily get that recognition all the time. Part of that is just continuing to try and continuing to do something new and, stand by what you do.
The credibility factor, too. Yeah. Like this idea of an overnight success takes 10 years kind of thing. Right. I mean, we have both been, working very hard and long in this town at a lot of places for a really long time. And, the cronut, like, he was introduced to the world, but we all knew about him, and he has a very long history of an incredible work ethic, and he still holds that work ethic, and as do I, and I've been in this town for quite a while, and we have been, you know, we have been watching and working and listening and ingesting, and, you know, and that's part of it too. It's like, this wasn't overnight success. I mean, it looks like that to the world.
It's funny, I had this question coming back a few times. People were telling me, oh, you just try once, and it's an overnight success. No. I was like, no, I've been trying for over 20 years.
Exactly. Every single day. Yeah, 20 years.
Every single day trying to get better.
That's right.
Every single day trying to push yourself, you know, to be stronger in what you do and
exactly.
reaching out to people.
Right.
So it's not an overnight success. It's over 20 years of trying.
And I think that helps as a catalyst to get people to want to try it, right? Because it's not just a new thing from some new face. It's like, it's the new thing from the guy who's been around for a really long time who built credibility through, you know, a lot of work.
Well, so that being said, when you're the guy who has been around for a really long time and built credibility, what are the downsides of all of a sudden being caught up in this perfect storm where you are identified with something like the Cronut when you've said yourself that's far and away from being even personally your favorite pastry or perhaps the pastry you're most proud of? You like the DKA, and yet people like me call you Mr. Cronut, and that must rankle you a little bit. So what are the downsides, and how do you feel about the slew of imitators that have popped up, and all of a sudden people have broth on their menus, or the Cronut imitators there, we could go on forever listing them. Like,
I mean,
so
I think there's a few downsides to the story, but I think most of it is like great things that came out of it. I remember the first year we auctioned off 24 Cronuts for charity to fight against hunger, and we raised over $100,000.
Wow.
And it's, you know, it's, yes, we can, yes. And it's something, you know, that was important to me. I grew up not necessarily having enough food, and it's something that I really care for. I remember someone tweeted me, we're talking about social media, tweeted me one day, and they were comparing the Cronut line to the soup kitchen. And this is where I got involved, and I started talking to this girl and see how I could help. And this is how I began, like, helping more for charities and being even more involved than I was before. And this is something great that came out of it. I think another side of the story is that this opened so many doors. Like, because we as chefs have been trying for many, many years, always doing new things, always pushing ourselves to get better, to make better food. And when something like this happens, people just pay a little bit more attention to everything else you do. It's still very creative. It's still like we were before, as creative, as good, as tasty. You just get a little bit more attention for what you do, and you have more chance of explaining the direction you want to take and your creativity.
So I would love to hear the restaurateurs' perspective on this. Obviously, you know, Luke, for those of you who don't know, Andrew Carmelini is the partner and chef behind the restaurants in the NoHo Hospitality Group. But Luke, as the guy who's outside of the kitchen, I would imagine that a lot of the onus kind of falls on you to get the bead of what's going on in restaurant culture and, you know, sourcing trends and seeing what's really needed in the environment. So how have you kind of identified really with all of your restaurants going back to Avoce, but certainly with all of your restaurants now, how do each of them represent in the moment in time kind of trends that you identified and then tried to answer?
That's a good question.
It's a big question.
It's a big question, yeah. You know, I agree with, you know, Marco said earlier about, you know, the trend, the sort of hot flash in the pan, quick moment that sometimes sticks around for a really long time and sometimes goes away very quickly, can be very dangerous. And I think we've taken an approach, you know, in our group to not get too caught up on any particular trend, just because it can be, you pigeonhole yourself a little bit into that category that could not be successful. I think a lot of it for us is at the same time trying to be at the forefront of what's going on and being part of the conversation. We've taken every project that we've done individually, and we've looked for some type of unique way to tell another part of the story, contribute another chapter to the book of what's going on in this town. And, you know, whether it was La Conda Verde when we opened up about 6.5 years ago or so, it was a real dangerous time to open up a restaurant. The market had just crashed, you know, a handful of months before, and we took the opportunity to try to do something that was not necessarily revolutionary and new, but really trying to reach more to what we were looking to eat and how we wanted to eat and what we thought New Yorkers were really looking to eat and what type of restaurant they wanted, and kind of stripping away that white tablecloth, fancier approach, and have it be a little bit more affordable than sort of that uptown scene. And or in the case of something like the Dutch, which was the second restaurant that we opened, you know, looking at American food as a whole and trying to do a little bit of a unique approach to tell a little bit of our own version of a story of what we believe American food is, which is obviously and quite obviously such an eclectic collection of different styles of cooking and food and ingredients and philosophies of food in America. And we did a lot of traveling around and tried to take as much information back from those travels and experiences and use a little bit of ideas and kind of not have such a four-wall limitation of what is being cooked at a place like the Dutch, but keeping the underlying story American, an American story. And we've done that throughout restaurant to try to tell some type of authentic story that means something to us, but is also really, I think, relevant to the times and the city and the demographics that we are surrounded by. I think relevance, too, I think about it a lot. I think staying relevant, you know, can be defined in so many different ways. And I think one of the most important things to do if you are trying to be in industry or game or life in general and continue to try to do something or be relevant in what you do, I think you have to define it for yourself. And I think the definition is different for everyone. I'm sure the three of our definitions of what's relevant or what's important or trend, there's probably some similarities, but it's probably a different story between each. And, you know, whether it be a specific item that can be super popular, or whether it's financial success or it's notoriety or it's some combination of 2 or 3 or 10 of those. And I think for us, you know, for me, it is some type of collection. I think it's hard in this type of business to do something that might set a trend or be very popular for a quick minute or 2 years, and then all of a sudden that bus leaves and you're left with a pretty expensive business to run and try to make profitable and have a lot of employees and responsibility to hold those jobs for people, let alone pay your taxes, et cetera, et cetera. But, so I think it's some type of combo. I think you always have to see what's going on around you, pay attention to where you are, pay attention to what you think people want, also pay attention to what you want, and hopefully that matches a little bit, and try to put forth an authentic story. I think that combination helps. Doesn't always work out perfectly, but.
Well, even without riding the wave of one particular dish, you guys and your restaurants have remained, you know, pretty much in the public consciousness for a long time. As soon as the attention for our preemie starts to wane, then you come out with Little Park. But, you know, what? How do you toe the line? When in that quest to stay out there and reinvent and push yourself and explore new spaces and new places and new concepts, when do you run the risk of diluting your brand, overexhausting yourself, even alienating your audience?
I ask that question every single day. It's tough. It's tough to find the balance of trying to not dilute your brand, or if anything, feel that anything you're putting forward on a daily basis is not as good as it can be. And we had some pretty rapid growth, you know, in the last 5-6 years, with about 7 restaurants now in a relatively short period of time, and took a purposeful pause this year, particularly, to kind of reflect upon what we have, look back about how we can take everything we have and potentially make it stay relevant and maybe even be better forever and ever, and never try to lose that approach and be better prepared, I think, for the future. At the same time, our approach certainly is we look for opportunity. We look for opportunity to also collaborate with people that work with us. And, you know, talent, Mark and I were talking about it outside a little bit, recruiting talent, finding good people, retaining good people, I think is one of the most difficult parts of the hospitality industry as a whole. And we've looked at opportunities potentially to be able to do new projects and new restaurants to foster talent that we have within, because Carmelini, myself, my other partner Josh, is absolutely impossible for all three of us to be at every single place at the same time. I think most of New York has gotten used to that for people that have multiple restaurants. At the same time, we have such incredible teams within our restaurants that, to be honest, we are probably doing better jobs than we would if we were there on a nightly basis anyway. They're fostering, nurturing really top talent and trying to create new platforms and stages for them to perform on. And so we take that in consideration a lot when we look at new opportunity and projects. Sometimes it really truly is just a really great space on a corner that we have a really great idea, that that perfect storm of timing and demographic and neighborhood and location, and we have the right people who are ready to go, and it all kind of comes together, a little false magic, if you will. But sometimes it's just not right. It doesn't feel right. It's not the right place. It's not the right deal. It's not the right building. We don't have the right people. It really depends, to be honest with you.
You've said it yourself that obviously none of you are flashes in the pan. You have, you know, real name recognition, a lot of respect, and of course with the NoHo Hospitality Group, you got some big money backers. The money is there, and it's all working as one. But for newer restaurateurs without a lot of money, without capital, without name recognition, how do they even get themselves out there without trying to be Dominique? And, you know, what is this crazy mashup dessert that I'm going to make that's going to make me the darling of Instagram for a month and then I fade away? What advice do you have for restaurateurs who are not you?
Go to a different city.
Yeah, maybe go to a different city.
A lot of them are.
Very, very difficult to break in as a young guy. And that's in every industry. I mean, if you're a young artist, it's like, you know, this isn't the Soho is no longer the place for the young artist, and neither is West Chelsea,
and neither is Williamsburg. Thank you, White Hotel.
And that applies to all the industries, really. And if you want to be young and scrappy and startup-y, it's probably not the best city to try to expose yourself to, because there's so much noise here, and the cost of business here is exorbitant, and it's very difficult to make it viable. And you know, Luke is in an incredibly fortunate position of having the resources and behind him and his group, and that really allows them to do so much that a young scrappy startup guy would never even be able to fathom doing, right? And that's real, and that's relevant, and it really speaks to that question, I think.
Yeah, and that in same vein, it took a long time to build, obviously, just like you're 20 years before the Cronut. You know, my partners, myself, we certainly put a long run of time to get to a certain point to be able to find some type of opportunity that coincided with also some luck and some timing and some good ideas and the right demographic that materialized into one great restaurant. And then we use the experience from that and the success from that as a catalyst to create the second restaurant. And that sort of built upon itself. And it is true, I think going from one restaurant to two restaurants is one of the hardest things you can possibly do, because you have probably almost no resource, no crew, you're splitting your time, you're running back and forth. I actually think it's very, very, very difficult. Going from two to three or three to even five, it's very, very difficult. It's near impossibility every single time, but it's different. It's at that point you are forced to have a much bigger team, and you have a lot of talented people, hopefully, that are helping to support the mission of what you have, and maybe several chefs helping, big crews, lots of general managers, director of operations, human resources, good accounting teams. That will help inevitable growth, there's no question. But starting out in this town, I agree. I think it's, for restaurants and hospitality, there's never been a harder time to start in New York than today. And I don't think it's necessarily because there's so much competition or people are different or eating trends have changed, even though that's all pieces of the pie. I think just honestly, logistically and financially in this town, it's become so complicated with costs of doing business to actually make any type of profit where you can use that to stay open or open up another one or grow.
Yeah.
So I would say for that young person who's trying to figure it out and trying to start out, I wouldn't rule out the idea of collaboration. And I think that is the new found future of how to get involved is certainly don't try to do it by yourself. I mean, you can, for sure, but it definitely helps to have partners and good ones. It definitely helps to find other people or more significant groups that might be more established that can collaborate on a really great idea that you have that you can do together, and maybe they have the resource and backing. But that's not the only way, and I don't want to be uber discouraging or move out of town. That is another option. But New York has a lot of opportunity. It's kind of the city of opportunity, but it has changed in the last 10 years. There's so many cities now that have such dynamic and amazing restaurant scenes and such talented people that are going to those cities to work for there. I think there's a lot more choice. Mm-hmm. So it's yeah.
Dominique, I would love to hear your perspective. I'm willing to bet that you've got a lot of people out there excited to be the possibility of being a pastry chef, which for years, and I know that you must have faced this yourself, it's been really hard for pastry chefs to get respect and get from out under the shadow of the savory chef. Traditionally, there's just not a lot of attention paid to pastry chefs. A lot of restaurants, when they think of, the bottom line and what they could cut, they do away with the pastry chef and the in-house dessert program. So I bet there's a lot of people out there that really they've seen what you've done, and there's a real opportunity for people to make a statement with pastry. But again, how does somebody who's not you, who hasn't captured lightning in a bottle, get a foothold as a pastry chef?
I think it's there's a lot of things that comes together. It's very important to have no fear and never stop believing in what you do. It takes time. It takes time to build a reputation. It takes time to build your career. It takes time to have customers that come and come back to you. It takes time to build, and it's not something that people should forget. I know that nowadays kids, they come out of school and they want to work less hours. They don't want to work weekends. They want a lot of money. And it's an investment. This, like the food industry, it's a tough one. It's a tough one to make money. Either you have a small business, like one restaurant, one bakery, or you have six or seven. Money is never unlimited. There's a limit for everyone. The bigger the space, and yes, the more pressure you have because you have more employees, you have more cost, and you have to really make money. It's something that, as I say all the time, it's not just a job. It's a lifestyle. And working in the food industry, you have to work hard and you have to keep on believing you can do something better. You can bring something different as well.
So I'm interested to know, are there any other chefs or restaurants or hospitality groups that you particularly admire for their ability to remain relevant for a long period of time?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Alfred Portale at Gotham Bar and Grill. Just blows my mind that guy has been doing what he's doing. Three times New York Times, 3-star reviews. He's been there for almost over 30 years, I think. Mm-hmm. He's still in his restaurant. He still draws the crowds. He has made the conscious decision to not grow. I think he's had a lot of opportunity to do it. And he wanted to define his success differently than a lot of other people. And it's really, I really respect that about the guy. And I think that's a shining example of somebody who's remained relevant and resisted the urge to grow and has learned to say no. And it's a beautiful restaurant that, I went there last year, and sat down and had a tremendous meal. And I was like, I hadn't been there for, I think, 15 years before that. And I remember when I got into the city in the late 90s, it was one of the restaurants, like I looked in the window and I was like, God, like I want to work in a cool New York City restaurant like Gotham Bar and Grill. And, so he's one for me. I really respect what he's done.
Yeah, I would say for me, I think Union Square Hospitality Group, what Danny's done is certainly an impressive feat because it's so diverse but it still has a sort of underlying tone of clarity in what their mission is, which is really giving such great hospitality, whether you're serving a burger or you're putting the 4-star plate together. And I think they're also very impressive, I think, especially in the last few years, and bringing some very talented people who are not necessarily restaurant people into their group to help them really actually establish big business, which is what they were able to do with Shake Shack. While still keeping it very true to truly just a really great hamburger. So he's had some good balance. And, you know, Daniel Balut, I worked with Daniel years ago, and I have to be honest with you, he's kind of the same guy he's always been. His business has just changed, and but his priority has never changed, which is just trying to always make it the best and trying to always be food focused and food forward. And I think their group is very impressive, the talent they're able to obtain, because it really is. You talked a little bit about how it's so hard to find people that, you know, especially at a school, who only want to work the 40 hours and don't want to work weekends. And, you know, Danielle, I'm sure, gets a lot of that also, for sure. But there's still a group of people that have been there, you know, in the last 15, 20 years working by his side and still remain there now. And they collect some really good talent. So both of those groups are certainly, have always been very impressive to me.
What about you?
I agree with you. Like, a lot. I really respect Danny Meyer and what he's done for all of his restaurants. I think the culture in all of his places is amazing. People really care. People are really careful for the food. They care for the restaurant. They care for the customers that come every day. Daniel has been doing amazing. I mean, I worked for him for 6 years. I've learned so much from him, and he's one of my mentors. But also the whole hospitality. I was talking to Andrew Carmini last week, and I was telling him how much I love his restaurants. And I really mean this, because every time I go to one of his places, the food is great, and the people care so much as well. I often go to the Dutch, yeah. And I think the team
we're
is
like
amazing there.
Right, so.
They have ownership. They love their restaurant. They love the team that they built, and you see, they care for it. Every time there's a holiday, they do something special. They welcome the regular. They do a special menu. They invite you over. They have a lot of ownership, and they really care for what they do. And I think you guys do an amazing job. And you see it in the food, you see it in the hospitality, and you see it in your success as well.
Thanks.
And Luke didn't pay you to say that, right?
He did not. Not yet.
Something under the chair.
Not yet, indeed.
And is there, you know, an addition to the culinary zeitgeist, like, God help us, the ramen burger, that you've just looked at and been like, man, I wish I had thought of that?
Yeah, the cronut.
I didn't pay him to say that.
It's an exchange of services.
I mean, I think every restaurateur, chef, like, would love to have that cronut or the Shake Shack, you know, that one idea. I think everyone, well, that's not true. Not everyone wants necessarily that. There's certain personalities that tend to go for other things also. But if you can come up with that one great idea that gets so much notoriety for just the fact that it's so damn good, it's kind of a dream for chefs or restaurateurs or management to be able to, because you put so much work and time and effort into trying to make that thing really, really good. So it's great to get the recognition from it. You know, I would, to your point earlier, it's probably not all good attention all the time, but it can also be very flattering, I think, if there's all the people imitating, you know, whether it be the cronut.
To a certain extent,
you know, it could also be pretty cumbersome and kind of annoying after a while, too, I'm sure.
You're not flattered by Stu Leonard's take on the cronut? I was excited when I saw it. If I was you, I would have been excited.
You know, as a chef, we always push ourselves to create new things. And I think this is what all chefs should be doing. So when people take your ideas as inspiration to create something new, I think this is great. You lead something, you start something, and you take them somewhere else. I think when people, and especially big companies, try to replicate what you've created and purposely trick customers to make them think it's something else, I think there's a line where it's not flattering anymore, yeah. But it's more like trying to trick people.
Yeah.
And this is just for business. And what we do at the bakery, we've purposely decided to not sell out, to not mass produce our cronut, and to stay true and authentic to the quality and to our creation. And every day we limit ourselves to what we can produce. And it's about quality, it's about service, and it's about selling something real. Of course, I could have opened like 100 cronut shops, Of course, I could have been like, I could have had the cronut in every supermarket. I decided not to do it. I decided not to stay out, to sell out, but to keep moving on and to keep on creating. And this is what, for example, a new shop is about. We opened a new bakery in a West Village about 4 months ago. And this is all about, we take thyme as an ingredient and we make all desserts to order. So 80% of the menu is dedicated to like fresh quality products. So we keep on moving on with new ideas, with new concept, with new product, and we don't stand with one thing and try to blow it out.
So we must close with a you heard it here first moment. Any projects in the work, exciting developments that you could share with us today? Give the scoop, guys. That's paying me under the table.
I just opened a shop in Japan about 2 months ago. So, and we opened the shop in West Village about 4 months ago. So, fairly busy right now.
I'd imagine so. What about you guys? I mean, Little Park is still a baby.
Little Park is still the baby on the block. So we are taking our time with that one and just trying to get it right. It's going to take a little while to get it right. All of our restaurants take a little while. I feel like we've never gotten it right. So. We have nothing new on the development horizon. We are trying to make what we do a little bit better.
I'm kind of excited to do like a little bit of a Hearth 2.0 relaunch after the new year. So I'm very excited about that. And in terms of Brodo, you know, I'm incredibly excited and happy and enthused by what happened. I think it's a great thing to drink. I think that it checks a lot of boxes. And I want to try to, you know, grow it as strategically and as smartly as I can. I think that it's a great alternative hot beverage. I'd like to think that quite possibly I created an alternative hot beverage. And I'm going to see where it goes. But we've got some things in the works. Nothing to really disclose at the moment.
All right, I'll give you my cell phone number.
Yeah, exactly.
Guys, it's been astounding to share this stage with you. Needless to say, visit all of their establishments. Check out, of course, the broadcast of the show at Taste Talks at Heritage Radio, as well as all of the amazing episodes that we did during the year. This one really topped it out because look at who I'm sitting with. Thank you so much for coming today. Thank you guys so much for chatting.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Maybe you could pester them with your questions on their way out the door.